morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday, the state superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers, put forward a proposal funding our future that would increase state funding for public education. It would also change the school funding system. 2.4 increase in state aid in the first year of budget 2013 to 2015 and a 5.5% increase in 2014 to 2015. He says it would put on track a return to two-thirds state support for public school costs. This hour, we are looking at this issue of whether or not school districts are hurting. Did last year's cuts to teachers' benefits offset school aid losses? Are poor districts suffering more than richer districts? Is there a better way to fund our schools? Big issues on the table this hour, and we'll be talking with one of our regular education guests, Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. This is an issue that I know many of you have thoughts about, and you are welcome to join our conversation anytime during the hour, 800-486-8655, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, post on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page, or tweet if you would like at K Dunn Show. Professor Steve Correa, nice to have you with us again. Hello.
Oh, very glad to be here, and good morning.
Yeah, good morning to you. Let's start with the state superintendent's proposal, Funding Our Future, that was outlined earlier this week, increasing state funding for public education. Is this a big, hearty, substantial proposal calling for substantial changes to funding?
You know, Wisconsin has a very unusual system in that the state superintendent, of course, is a constitutional position. It's right in there. One of the five state offices that the state constitution stipulates. However, it has no funding mechanism, so it's dependent on the legislature to approve money. And, of course, the budget to the legislature is given by the governor. So the governor can either pay attention to this or just simply ignore it, like a Christmas card from a friend they don't want to talk to anymore. And so while certainly Superintendent Evers is doing his duty to present this, there's no obligation for the state to pay any attention. And so it provides this odd sort of circumstance where the state superintendent politically, historically, has almost always been oriented with the Democratic Party. And, of course, when you have a Republican in control of the executive branch and the legislative branch, boy, you know, that's not the best relationship to go on a long car ride together. These people don't get along terrifically well.
Right.
And so what Evers has proposed doing, to begin with, Dr. Evers has announced recently that he does indeed plan to run for reelection.
Right.
So one must look at these things within a political context and not exclusively within an educational context. So this is part of the way he's able to differentiate or distinguish some of his goals. But his idea is, I think it's about a 2.5% increase in 2013 and then an even bigger 5.5% increase for the next year. And his goal is to target graduation rates and factor in poverty since it has such a tremendous effect on school performance. And as of right now, poverty is not a part of the formula, taking account of children poverty or the poverty that children grow up in. But we do know that it has a tremendous effect on school performance. So Evers is trying to account for that in this funding proposal, to be able to provide that to districts so that they can do more to address those poverty needs and help those students to achieve higher graduation rates and increased academic performance.
Professor Correa, let me just ask a general question. Give us an overview of the state. He would be calling for an increase in state aid for schools. Would you say that there are a number of districts in the state that are hurting? They don't have enough teachers. They don't have enough good enough facilities. They don't have programs they need. Or are there just a handful that are hurting? Or maybe there aren't any that are hurting?
Well, and again, I think that's a good way to be able to look at it. I think probably in its present state, the districts have adjusted fairly well to the changes that came down in the last biannual budget. They have accounted for, they've been able to move money from pot A to pot B, and they're doing acceptably well. I don't think we'll see any huge statistical differences in school performance. However, it doesn't take a capitalist to figure out that if we're going to continue to have lower salaries, to provide districts with fixed at best funding, while every place else in the world prices are going up, it doesn't take, like I say, a real economist to be able to determine that over time, there is just simply, it defies logic to think that school districts are going to be able to continue to provide the level of education that the state of Wisconsin has come to expect. Now, the most recent budget that was enacted did clearly impact low poverty districts in a much more severe way than no poverty districts. Here's just a great example. The city of Milwaukee has about 90,000 students that live at or below the federal poverty level. Just a staggering number. Wonderful little Kohler district, of course, near Sheboygan, have zero students that are at free and reduced lunch rates. Just simply look at what those two districts have to deal with, and it's so different. So high poverty districts spend about, $7,400 a student per year. That's what they get from the state. Low poverty districts get about $3,400 from the state. High poverty districts got their budgets cut by about $700 a student, or about 10%. Low poverty districts got their budgets cut about $300 per student, or about 10%. Okay, do the math. High poverty districts lost a higher dollar amount and a higher budget amount simply because they got more money, so their funding was cut. So they need to do more with less. Their demands are increasing. Low poverty districts do not have those challenges. So as you project that out over time, if we continue to double the hit that poor districts have, they are just not going to be able to meet the expectations that the state of Wisconsin expects.
So the state superintendent, let's talk about how he would target those poor districts. What does his proposal call for?
Part of what Dr. Evers has proposed for also involves this idea of factoring into the school formula, to the school funding formula, the numbers of non-English speakers in the district, the number of free and reduced lunch students that students have. And by the way, districts are now aggressively pursuing breakfast programs and evening or end-of-the-day meal programs. So these are not people looking for a free handout. These are children who sometimes this is their only meal. So part of what Evers has proposed, that part of the race to the top with the Obama administration, is they have to be able to provide evidence of effective preparation for college and career-ready students. These students from high poverty districts are not going to be college and career ready unless that factor is accounted for. So part of this increase in funding that Dr. Evers has proposed is to account for that and programs to be able to help with English speaking skills and then, of course, the entire array of skills and communication skills and needs that those students have, let alone other things like lunches and food and the other kind of combination of things. Right now, there is no recognition of that within the school funding formula, And so Evers is trying to factor that in.
Mm-hmm. The Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, as you know, also issued a report recently saying that the governor's cuts to public workers' benefits and limits to collective bargaining that took place last year offset about two-thirds of the reductions to school revenue resulting from that budget. Would you say that's a pretty fair assessment of things? And what about the other third? Have there been cuts in teachers? Is that a way to deal with less school aid? And is that what schools have done?
Well, the Wisconsin Taxpayers Group, they are correct, yes, because what the governor did was they gave districts ways to have lower expenses, just quite frankly. You don't have to pay as much salary. You don't have to pay as much in benefit. And we're going to balance that by taking away extra money or money that would have been given to you originally. Clearly, the governor decided, and the Republican legislature, that they did not want that state money going to teacher benefits and, you know, health care, retirement programs, those kind of things. So in the short term, districts have been able to adjust, for the most part, pretty well. They have been able to do that. But if you look at about that one-third, and then you that's left over, and then you look at the high-poverty districts, which even by a modest measure is a little over 200 of Wisconsin's 420-some districts are poverty districts, districts with notable amount of poverty. So those districts now have to do just as much with less money. They laid off more teachers than the low-poverty districts. They got less money than the low-poverty districts. Over time, you can't continue to do that. Now, there are those out there, and there's interesting evidence for this, that this is actually part of a multi-step plan to bring in more charter schools, to expand choice programs, especially up the lakeshore if we want to think about Green Bay and perhaps La Crosse, other kind of more urban-ish areas, Madison as that case in point. And then to be able to even redirect more money from the public schools to be able to put those into charter schools. And then you see schools even having less money, and you see the traditional public school losing its look. It becomes much more diversified. It becomes much more spread out in the community. And there's also talk about changing teacher licensing in a variety of ways to be able to allow for what we presently consider as unlicensed teachers or uncertified teachers to be able to teach in different school districts. So, you know, it's a way to be able to fundamentally change the way schools operate and to do that with less money. Mm-hmm. So in the long run, it really does have the potential to be able to change the way public schools look.
Do you worry about that?
Yes, because can you just imagine if we licensed our physicians that way? How about our healthcare professionals? How about if we just decided that anybody who has a license right now, Well, we'll come multiple ways to be able to do that. And yet you look at the skill sets that teachers bring in and what we expect them to do, and then we're going to sort of open the gates for well-meaning but not necessarily trained teachers to be able to get in. Wow. It's certainly an attempt to dismantle. And what we have in Wisconsin, I mean, you know, people who are familiar with Wisconsin schools, you know, this is a phenomenal state for education. Third highest ACT scores in the nation, among the graduation leaders, highest AP takers, advanced placement in the Midwest, but we have the highest non-white achievement gap among eighth graders in math and a few other areas. So Wisconsin has challenges, but Wisconsin does a lot of things great. And part of these proposals are for choice and whatever, are not based on any evidence. They're just based on an idea that what we have, people don't like, or we can't afford it. And boy, you know, you can see a well-respected nationally recognized educational system not being able to sustain itself.
We will start taking phone calls. We have several of them coming in right now. We're talking about education in the state of Wisconsin. On Monday of this week, State Superintendent Tony Evers released a proposal, Funding Our Future, that would increase school aid. He also seeks to set a state funding level for districts of $3,000 per pupil. We're talking about the details of this plan, the effects of the cuts last year on teachers' salaries and on benefits, and that if that has offset some of the school aid losses. Are there districts in the state that are hurting? Do we have an equitable funding system as it is? Are we looking at, as Professor Correa is suggesting, a change in the way we educate our students because of financial worries? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You can email at talk@wpr.org, post on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or tweet to @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the author of the cover story, National Geographic, Cuba, on the edge of change. She spent 9 weeks over a two-year period of time looking at the island, and it's a fascinating story with, of course, gorgeous pictures. She will be with us hour two. To your phone calls now for Stephen Correa. He is Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College, and we go to Laura in Madison. Hi, Laura.
Oh, hi. Thanks to your guest for helping us try to understand this issue. Maybe you can help me with something that I just don't get about all of this. In theory, it certainly sounds good to, as he said, give more resources towards those areas where there are more impoverished children and they need the money more. But I tell you, and my actual experience has been living in Madison, and I put, you know, a kid through the public schools, and I saw us, you know, continually as voters being willing to put, you know, say yes to referendums, to raise more taxes, to help the, you know, close the achievement gap between the whites and the minorities. You know, we put sister schools together, paired schools, so that the rich kids and the poor kids would go to school together, and the poor kids would have every advantage that the rich kids did. And after 20 years of that program, there was absolutely no difference in the achievement scores of the black kids. And I see all kinds of other little indications that, at least to me, say that blacks aren't really valuing education. For some reason, they aren't seeing it as a path to success. And until they do, how is throwing money at the problem ever going to help?
Steve?
Well, that's, you know, part of what I think to start out with, I think that these programs try to give poor kids, poorer children, not necessarily every advantage, because quite frankly, not possible. They try to provide them with multiple opportunities. First, now, you know, school lasts from about 8:30 to 3:30, so we have to remember where that child is returning to, and that could be a variety of circumstances. Just because your parents are poor or you are poor does not mean you don't value education, doesn't mean you don't have goals in life, doesn't mean lots of great things. But it does mean that there are probably a whole host of factors in your circumstances. This sounds like a sociology class, doesn't it?
It's all part of education, right?
There's a whole host of factors that really challenge that child to be able to do well, including role models, including this idea of opportunities outside of education. You know, as an example, UW-Green Bay has this phenomenal program called Future Phoenix, and they go into local schools and try to get students to think ahead, of course, where they are thinking ahead is to become a Phoenix at UW-Green Bay. It's a really strong program. We have TRIO programs. We have Upward Bound programs. There is evidence that those programs do work, but it's a constellation of programs. I would probably argue that this isn't necessarily exclusively an African-American problem, but it is a problem with having families be able to look at education, trust the system. If you've never been through the system, then it's very, very foreign. You don't necessarily know how to negotiate it, talk about it. So the idea is you have to be able to provide a whole variety of support. Now, here's one way just to be able to pause and think about this. Look what we're not talking about. We're not talking about the child that comes to school ready to sit down and listen. We're talking a child that needs to have a whole variety of support mechanisms in mind. So you're not exactly talking about education exclusively. You're really talking about providing that child the support to be able to be ready to learn, to learn, and then to be able to make connections from that learning. Whereas the child with parents that have gone to college, that have, you know, we could say more advanced careers, perhaps are secure in their employment, et cetera, that's that child's lifestyle, that mindset. So it is more of a challenge. I would also argue that while those programs do work, to a lesser extent in some places, to a greater extent than others, we don't always know what exactly works. And so I think the caller's insightful. Sometimes we do think, let's just try this. Well, we need to get better at what does work. And so there are places that can replicate those. One of the challenges with charter schools, we don't know what charter schools work and don't work. So simply saying, let's do charter schools, we don't know which ones work. So we have to get better at deciding which ones work. So it's a complex problem, and there's not a simple solution. But the feds have said, we have got to have these students college and career ready, and Wisconsin has committed to that. So they're trying to find what works. But certainly everything doesn't work equally. Let's just demand that each child come from a loving family, that they talk about school every day. There are books in the school. Children love to learn. And at the end of the day, everyone wants to become a Badger or a Green Knight at St. Norbert College. Well, we know that's not the case. So, you know, so schools have taken on social services responsibilities, transportation, you know, on and on. It's just not the day where you walk in and say, open your books, and the child says, which one? As opposed to, I don't have it. So, you know, the caller's right. It's a complex problem. We have done some things that haven't been effective, but there are a number of things that the state and other places have done that are effective. It's not a simple solution. It's just not. But that doesn't mean we don't keep trying.
George in Springdale Township. Hi.
Yeah, this is a very good discussion, and I was wondering if the Evers proposal is dealing with some of the other issues related to the formulas, because the formulas are really a lot more complicated than even the discussion you're currently having, mainly because of the fact that they're based on this weird formula that looks at property tax valuation per kid.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how that is, can increase or decrease the amount of funding you have. And also the formulas, to my knowledge, don't take into account the cost of living in any area. In other words, the cost of living within the state varies over 100% from some of the small rural communities to some of the urban communities. And the formula tends to be working sort of detached from the economic realities of that. And that's sort of an interesting problem because in places in Dane County where there was a lot of development in the 1990s, depending on how that development was structured, in some cases the schools and the local governments actually put a cap on housing starts and other types of things because of the fact that every time they built a house, the increase in the property taxes from the schools was higher than the valuation on the house. And so we actually have a school tax formula that not only quite often doesn't serve the kids very well, and we also need to remember that high valuations in a community doesn't necessarily mean low poverty. In many cases, economic development actually increases poverty as opposed to decreases it, depending on what type you have.
Yeah, much has been made of some of the districts in northern Wisconsin, right, where there are a number of people who have summer homes or very fancy homes, and it messes up the whole, what you were just talking about, George. There's still a lot of poverty in those districts, but it works against those students.
And in a lot of the urban areas, I mean, when you have, I mean, for instance, if you look at Dane County, you look at the area around Milwaukee County, outside Milwaukee County, you have these bedroom communities that quite often have very high valuations, but also the major industry in there are strip malls and big box stores. And those families quite often are living in the lower, older, you know, rental properties. And so you have a place like Sun Prairie, which is looked upon as this, you know, middle-class bedroom community, that in Dane County has the second highest amount of kids on low-income child care subsidies. I mean, their number of kids on low-income child care subsidies are right under the areas that are considered to be really intense low-income housing projects in the city of Madison.
So, George, you obviously know a lot about this. What's the answer? What's the answer to it?
Well, you really have to look at a formula. You have to really no longer tinker with the formula, but actually do some serious revisions on it. And that gets to be really hard. I mean, it's like the 800-pound gorilla in order to fix this thing. Because a lot of the Republican proposals I've seen have tended to be, well, we just give this flat amount per kid, which of course doesn't take into account the cost of living. So that benefits a lot of the rural districts, would probably really hurt places like Milwaukee and Madison. But you somehow have to tie in the cost of living and if you're going to look at this progressive aspect in terms of how much can be taken care of at the local level, you need to be looking at this property tax valuation, because it really makes no sense to be at a point like we are right now where we're talking economic development. We're cutting school aid at the same time,
right,
but the economic development is not going to make up the school aid in the places where you can develop as quickly as you can. So you get into this interesting thing where, you know, Madison taxpayers are probably paying part of the school taxes, you know, through the state aid formula for places like Darlington, Wisconsin. But development is slowed in places like Madison and Verona and Sun Prairie and a lot of these places because of the fact that development doesn't pay off, and that's quite often because of the school tax formula. So it's a bigger, you know, we have multiple issues here. We have the issue of how do we actually help kids survive and excel and work their way out of poverty and be well-educated. On the other hand, we have the thing that, and that's part of economic development in the long term, which people never look at, and that is, you know, a lot of your problems right now in the industrial workforce in this state is tied to welfare reform, because we really wrote off a whole generation of kids by some simple stuff we could have done in 95 in welfare reform that would have led to a lot more school success and a far better workforce today. The children who are 3, 4, 5 years old in 95 when W-2 came in are now 21, 22. Those are the kids who are moving into industry or not moving into industry because of what we did with them at a younger age. But we have to be looking at this from what do we do to succeed with the kids, but also what works in terms of economic development.
Mm-hmm. Yet another piece to all of this. Professor Correa.
Well, George is very well informed, and he is exactly right. You know, Wisconsin's school funding formula is pretty much unchanged from the 1970s. And so that's about when this system came in place. We've had a few changes, a few tweaks here and there. We had the revenue caps of the Thompson administration. But, you know, basically he's right. And so districts that have high property values, and a specific example is Rhinelander, but a significant pocket of poverty, which, again, Rhinelander has a number of students, a high percentage on free and reduced lunches. Well, it looks to the state, well, you have lots of rich people because your property is valued highly. You get less money. And it's like, no, wait a minute. That's not the case at all. These are houses that are not occupied. So you're giving us less because we have a perception of wealth, but not real wealth. And George is exactly right. The Minocqua Hazelhurst Lake Tomahawk School District, just north of Rhinelander, much the same way. And they do have poverty, and they also have, by the way, pretty high transportation costs. So factoring in those issues, and the Evers proposal talks about that. Now, I don't know the exact way that that is factored in, but because they're trying to take into account poverty, I'd have to say that at least they're looking at that. Cost of living is a much more difficult thing to be able to factor into this formula. But the state of Wisconsin's formula is unchanged in approaching 50 years. And so we do need to find some way to be able to account for the changes. We also need to find ways now to account for changes in property value as property prices have plummeted. These places are going to get reappraised, which, quite frankly, Rhinelander, they're going to put on their seatbelt, because that means that they're going to get even less, yet proportionately be seen as still being more property rich. So they're going to get a double hit unless this formula is changed. So George is very insightful. I think he'd make a great guest.
Thanks, George, for your call. Email from Shelley in Green Bay: with all the social programs available, including the food stamp program and food pantries, why are children still going without food to this extent?
I think because, you know, food is like a bath. If you don't have one every day, you're going to notice, or somebody else is going to notice. These are, you know, who are we looking at doing these things? Now, the email came from Green Bay. Green Bay has this world-class social service agency called Paul's Pantry. This place is phenomenal. It's private, not public. It's the good of the community that supports that. You know, that's not federal money. Are we going to privatize now our support for those that are disadvantaged? Well, Paul's Pantry takes on that challenge. But, you know, Green Bay has seen an increase of homeless children. Can you imagine being a homeless child and going to school? Homelessness is increasing. Free and reduced lunches, increasing. So, you know, we just have a lot of push-pull factors, to use a good sociological term. And unfortunately, these children that are on the margins are the ones that every day need to have these needs met. So while I don't necessarily have the solution, the problem is ongoing. And again, we still need to be able to get these students up to reading levels and graduation rates. And, you know, holy cow, NPR did a great story yesterday about social service agencies along the New Jersey shore finding themselves out of business because they got flooded. So, you know, we just have all kind of factors making survival for people at the margins more difficult. And as anybody who watches Stephen Colbert says, tongue in cheek, though you don't always see his tongue in his cheek, where are these poor? I don't see them in my gated communities.
Right.
Well,
right.
They're out there.
Yes, they are.
You have to know where to look. We can't ignore that.
Yes, they are. Steve Correa, our guest, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. We're talking about education in the state of Wisconsin. Our conversation prompted by a proposal, Fund Our Future, that the State Superintendent of Education, Tony Evers, released on Monday of this week, that would increase school aid, also change a fairly complicated formula. We're looking at that formula and trying to determine whether or not districts are hurting, children are hurting in certain districts in Wisconsin, where that might be. How do we change that? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can also send us a tweet if you want. I forget about that. modern method of communication. That's at Kay Dunn Show. This afternoon at 12:30, we will be bringing you NPR News special coverage of President Obama's news conference. He hasn't had one of those in quite a few months. So join us for in-depth coverage and analysis. NPR News special coverage of President Obama's news conference at 12:20 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. Hour two of our program today, the National Geographic cover story is on Cuba, on the edge of change. Cynthia Gorney, who spent a number of months in Cuba over a couple of years, will be with us to talk about what's happened in the country 4 years after Fidel Castro formally handed Cuba's presidency to his younger brother, Raul. Back to your phone call, Sandy in Managua. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and thank you for taking my call. I wonder how these proposals will affect highly qualified professionals and businesses that want to come to our state. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Now, I'm not quite sure what we mean by highly qualified professionals, but I would believe that part of this funding is, of course, looking at schools and just trying to maintain the quality of education that happens in Wisconsin. So as one would project out, I would not think that if these kind of interventions, financial interventions, were able to take place, you know, Wisconsin schools should stay about even. Now, when you wake up, you realize that the chances of this proposal getting through the legislature are very, very slim. It's just not likely to happen. In fact, there will probably be proposals to even reduce funding for schools in Wisconsin. Well, the long-term effects are going to be you're going to have, now, some people don't consider this a bad thing, but you're going to have a narrowing of what people consider the function and purpose of education. It's not quite the topic of today, but if you look at the Common Core academic standards, which most of the states have adopted, Wisconsin included, we're looking at reading and math skills, and you need to be able to demonstrate those skills. So it's not the idea, you know, school districts are not going to have the money to continue to provide the constellation of opportunities for students. Orchestra, band, performance team, football, who knows what, debate, whatever the case it might be. That money is not going to exist. So will they be picked up by the private sector? Perhaps. Certainly that's the model in Europe. There's no high school soccer teams in Europe. There are community-based adolescent soccer clubs. But that's not what we do in the United States. The high schools and the school districts take on these broad functions. They don't have, well, some of our areas do have community bands, but that's a much more European idea, and everybody can play in those. Nope, in Wisconsin, we have our seventh-grade band and our eighth-grade orchestra,
right.
Those kind of things. But I think that you will see districts narrowing what they try to do because simply they're not going to be held accountable for opportunities for JV or ninth grade girls basketball. They're going to be held accountable for reading and math and graduation scores. So over the long term, you're going to see a shift of what education is and what we expect education to do. Now, the reality, children that come from parents and family backgrounds that have money and opportunity will provide those opportunities for students in other settings. Children that don't are not going to have an opportunity to participate in those.
Let's go to Sally in Madison. Hi, Sally.
Hi, thanks for this. I am enjoying it very much. I have not heard another essential element addressed, which is infrastructure. Here in Madison, as technology changes, as buildings age, all of these things cost lots and lots of money. And I'm wondering if the budget addresses this at all. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you, Sally.
Yeah, Sally, of course, is bringing up every superintendent's worst nightmare. I've got a leaking building. Can I ignore that for another year? No, you can't ignore leaks. You know, she raises issues, and I think the broader issue is costs increase everywhere. I just got my energy bill for the month, and it's more than last year. Gee, what a surprise.
Right.
But districts are going to have fixed, at best, budgets, and every place else budgets are going, or, you know, costs are going up. Well, districts, again, are going to have to look at this. Ooh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I don't have money for A. I've got to do B. I can't have toilets that won't flush, or, you know, whatever the case it might be. So the other thing to be able to consider as you're looking at this idea of fixed costs is probably instruction is going to end up being outsourced to ways that are less expensive. I had an interest. I know a local teacher who teaches advanced placement courses in the local district here. He projected that AP courses likely were going to start being taught online, and those children could take those at home on computers or take those after the end of the day in the computer lab, and one teacher with economy of scale could potentially teach 250 students. And, you know, we're looking at a very different educational experience. But again, if you're going to narrow what schools do, they can't spend the money here. They have to spend it there. And I think a lot of the people that are proposing reduced funding for schools are saying, good, that's what we want. You don't need to do all these things. It's reading, writing, and arithmetic. And so, again, it's a different look at what we want schools to do and be.
You have to hope, though, that somebody's going to seriously examine what the ramifications are of that kind of instruction, because they will be substantial, I would think.
Yeah, they will be. You know, we know that students learn best in classrooms mm-hmm. where there's good, complex, student-to-student discussion of topics, not necessarily having the teacher involved. Now, having the teacher present, but having the students discuss these things back and forth. Can that happen in a variety of venues? Sure. But it really does change, you know, what we mean by the skill sets. And we're looking at things like critical thinking and analysis and other kind of social values and awareness. But, you know, it's hard for teachers and districts to continue to fight this. They will continue to try, but their opportunity is going to be very limited.
John in Edgerton, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. My children do very well at school, and it's because I've encouraged them. You know, you talked a little bit earlier about trusting in the system, but, you know, I've instilled in them that it's a privilege and an honor, especially in America. You know, I just watched a documentary where a school in Africa had a lottery, and took a kid from surrounding villages, and every child was so honored to be there. It's my firm belief that test results, academic performance would go through the roof if parents, you know, a lot of my kids' friends, their attitude is time served. I have to go to school. And it wouldn't cost a dime for parents to instill in their children what an honor and privilege the American education system is. And it wouldn't cost a dime if they would do that. And I've noticed so many of my son's friends just aren't into it. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Steve.
Yeah, I think the caller's neat. I mean, I know I have two sons, and, you know, they both like to learn. It's just fun. Now, okay, I'm a teacher. We go to museums in the summer. We go to art museums. We read books. We actually watch PBS. We make connections all the time. Anybody that knows Ms. Frizzle, make connections. And it's exciting. By the way, they both don't always like school, but they like learning. And so, you know, perseverance, stick-to-itiveness, this too shall pass, what's your goal? It's a whole constellation of items that we need for kids to be able to be successful. Now, I don't know necessarily that it takes a village, but I do know it takes day in and day out paying attention to what that child is doing, talking about what's happening, and helping that child to be able to see value in that. And it really comes down to values. Oops, we're back to sociology. What do we want
right.
kids to be able to do? And again, when the values are very specific, now I'm not saying, I'm not making a judgment on whether that's right or wrong, but it fundamentally changes what we look at our educational system in the United States to do. 100 years ago, values were also taught in churches, social service companies. I had relatives in Massachusetts that belonged to the Portuguese American Club. I was convinced they did other things there, but they learned about heritage and relatives and extended families. We don't have those things that exist as much now. So schools have taken on more and more. But the family structures have changed. I think families want to do those things in many cases. So teachers have tried to take those on. And it's quite a menu that we expect from schools. And then, by the way, graduated, what do you mean you don't have a job? Well,
right.
you have to go get more education. Oh, it's harder to get Pell Grants. It's harder to get in, et cetera, et cetera. The challenges increase when we provide less opportunity for the students to be able to get in. We just had a presidential candidate. I think Romney was serious when he said, borrow money from your parents. We don't have many people whose parents have the money for them to borrow. So this is an awareness of the challenges if we want these people to be able to do those things.
Let's try to get a few more phone calls in. John in Hartford, hi.
Yes, good morning. Hey, great topic. I'm actually a school administrator in the car right now on a way to a meeting talking about our costs, and I had two quick points. The first is I know we talk a lot about the Evers formula and state aid. What I want to make sure people understand is state aid is not the same as revenue. Changing the aid doesn't really change our revenue at all. It just changes the proration between the property taxpayers and what the portion the state picks up. Second quick point would be, and we're talking about revenue, and I think what gets lost sometimes is just about any new revenue, whether be coming from the state or coming from the federal government, has so many strings attached. And sometimes we don't necessarily need a whole lot more revenue. We just need more flexibility to use the resources we have to better meet the needs of our students. I know in Hartford we have much different needs than some of the districts around us, but sometimes we're forced to fit a one-size-fits-all at the state level.
Professor Correa.
I think, yeah, the caller brings up a good point. Those vocabulary terms are very important to be able to keep in mind. He also touched on the idea, what has also happened here is the previous budget that was passed limits how much local districts can make up the deficit in how much the state has reduced aid. So even if districts wanted to, they cannot put a ballot measure up that says we want to increase 200%. They're not allowed to do that by state statute. So that's an important thing to be able to mention. Also, if state funding does increase the districts, highly unlikely, as I'm sure our caller knows, but if that does happen, you can bet there are going to be strings on that, interestingly, because they're going to say, you can't use this extra money for teacher salaries. You can't use this extra money for health benefits. You can't use this extra money for work conditions. You can use it for X program or Y program. But but they're not really going to empower the local districts to make that choice because, again, they don't want that. You know, it's an interesting change. It's removing a lot of the tradition of local control because that's the very thing the state is trying to reduce that money and reduce what local districts do. So he's insightful with the idea of, you know, we know what works, mm-hmm. but there, you know, I think if you do see an increase, it's not going to be a carte blanche.
Thanks, John, for the call. Professor Steve Correa, thanks as always. Professor Steve.
I enjoyed it. My voice is giving out, but I always enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. It's a time of year, right? Go rest it, and we'll call you again. Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Education at St. Norbert College. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your phone calls. There were many. We'll be on the topic again, I can assure you. A great hour on Cuba is coming up.